Funding for THINK comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to THINK on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What does it take to interpret a musical based on a play based on two novellas that drew their inspiration from a writer's true life experiences in 1930s Berlin? The Dallas Theater Center's production of Cabaret has been hailed by critics as a stunning interpretation of the show that debuted on Broadway in 1966. That was a cut from the Dallas Theater Center's production of Cabaret, which continues at the Wiley Theater through this Sunday, May 22nd. Joining us to talk about it, we have director and choreographer Joel Farrell and actress Kate Weatherhead, who plays Sally Bowles. Welcome both of you to THINK.
Thanks, Chris.
Thank you.
So I want to start by talking about the source material. As I mentioned in the introduction, the musical is like a Russian nesting doll in some ways in terms of its inspiration and its sources.
Right.
Can you talk about how far back into that history you needed or wanted to go, Joel, to really understand what you wanted to do with this?
Well, as far back as I could, because I think the gooey goodness of any production, if you're lucky enough to sort of get to it, is research to some degree, mm-hmm. and exploring all of that. But the Berlin stories are really, truly fascinating because we have hindsight now. But of course, you know, Christopher Isherwood was just traveling around Europe, experiencing whatever he came across, and they're oddly. He literally just wrote down what he experienced. I mean, I assume what most writers do until they get into fiction world. But it is really fascinating to go back and read them because what strikes me over and over again is how could he know what was coming? How could he possibly know what was coming? How could any of them know? And I think you read in these stories that he certainly had a sense. It was beginning to get unnerving by 31, 32, 33. But I cannot imagine that there was a human being on the planet that truly knew how terrible things were going to get. And because I was a horrible history student, really bad, I had never really gotten my head wrapped around World War I. Mm-hmm. And it's ugly end and the Treaty of Versailles and the fact that, you know, what Germany, who of course thought they would win the war and had mortgaged themselves to the hilt sort of in order to do that, then suddenly were between reparations and just sort of the anger from the people who did actually win. That period between 1919 and 33 when Hitler became chancellor was insane. I mean, I as crazy as I think our political times are right now, it just was, you know, there were 24 political parties. The inflation went into just sort of insane world. I mean, you know, they were deeply affected, having their own depression and deeply affected by our depression, all of that. And so as with any scenario, I don't know that there's any amount of studying it that can truly make any one of us right now viscerally understand how confusing, how frightening, how overwhelming the landscape of that was as it changed. But I do have to say that I think what scares me a little bit about delving into this material is that truly I worry about what my response would have been. You know, I examine myself personally and think, oh, gosh, there's nothing I love better than pretending it won't get as bad as it's going to get.
And Kate, you play a character who never acknowledges in her personal life or certainly in the world of politics, there's, you know, discussions about how she hasn't picked up a newspaper and she's paying no attention. On the other hand, there is this sort of energy that is building throughout the show. And I wonder for you and for the other actors what that's like to sort of brush off this thing that you know at the end of Act Two is going to be there and is sort of creeping in even before then and maintain, sort of be true to that moment that you're in without thinking ahead to, we won't spoil anything, but the very shocking sort of final moments.
Yeah, well, I think that's been an ongoing exercise for all of us. And in the rehearsal process, I feel like that kept coming up for me, particularly playing Sally Bowles, who chooses to keep her head in the sand about pretty much everything. And often we would be in a scene and I would turn to Joel and I say, I really have to turn myself off right now. I cannot play the ending of this show. I can sort of never play the ending of this show because she just refuses to acknowledge what's happening around her. And in a way, that has been the greatest challenge because I, as someone living today and as an artist appreciating the piece as a whole, you know, on a very cerebral and emotional level, I'm overwhelmed by it. I'm moved by it. And I have to constantly keep that at bay as I try and remain true to Sally, who willfully ignores these issues and the brewing storm around her. And the scene in which that becomes the hardest is when the character of Fräulein Schneider, she runs a boarding house, which is where the character Cliff, who's based on Christopher Isherwood, comes to stay. And she is a German Gentile who forms a romantic attachment to one of her boarders who is a Jew. And am I allowed to talk about what she... Anyway, there's
sure.
So there's a moment where she basically decides because of the political pressure that she can't continue this relationship. She sings this unbelievably poignant and tortured song about what she's experiencing. And Sally is in that scene the whole time. And when she leaves, Sally says, "Should I speak to her?" And Cliff says, "What would you say?" And she says, "Oh, it'll all be fine. It'll work out." And then she makes fun of this character. And it's brutal. It's brutal. And yet, Sally's not, it's not malicious. You know, she just can't face it. She just, it's too much for her to even handle that someone would be that upset or, you know, going through such a dark time. You know, she just doesn't want to deal with it.
I'm always interested to hear about whether audiences actually think of Sally as someone who truly doesn't get it at all, or what I feel like when I watch Kate play it, which is one of the reasons I wanted Kate to come play it, is that I feel like there's another layer going on, which is that she is actually in her somewhere quite bright enough and sensitive enough to see things cracking and going wrong and whatever. But there is a sadness and a fear and a desperation in her that, you know, I mean, it's an age-old cliche, but you just keep dancing as fast as you can. I mean, there are several responses to fear. And, you know, one is flight and one is fight. And one of them is I'll just drink and dance, you know, and make it go away. And I think, you know, what has been interesting to hear, this never ceases to amaze me because, of course, the other great character in the show is the audience, because they bring their own ideas to this in terms of what they think about the Holocaust or what they think about people who live differently than themselves, whatever. And so I certainly think the easy thing to say about Sally Bowles is she buries her head in the sand. But I think what's intriguing is that I'm not sure anybody in 1931-32 Berlin could actually be completely oblivious, you know.
Your bro, you should have known by now you'd every cause to doubt me, mine.
only up and down, but side to side, mein Herr. I couldn't ever cross it if I tried, mein Herr. But I do what I can, inch by inch, step by step, mile by mile, man by man, by mine.
That is Kate Weatherhead in the Dallas Theater Center's production of Cabaret. She is my guest this hour, along with director and choreographer Joel Farrell. The interesting thing to me about the character of Sally Bowles is that everyone has in their head, and forgive me for saying this, everyone thinks Liza Minnelli when they think of this role. And the choices that you both have made for this, your Sally Bowles is not Liza Minnelli. She's much more vulnerable. She's fragile. She looks like she could break at any moment. To me, she's just a disaster in 19 ways, whether she's aware of it or not. But did you both consciously think, we don't want to do Liza?
You want me to go first?
Kate goes first.
Well, I think when they asked me to do it, I thought, well, obviously they don't want Liza Minnelli.
Right.
because if they did, they'd ask somebody else. So whatever, I just figured, well, they must want my... It is a collaborative interpretation, so I don't want to say I came in here with a fully realized part because I didn't. But I was aware enough of sort of the qualities that I bring to a performance, and I thought, well, they must want to exploit those. So,
what do you see those qualities as?
I'm a slight person in life, So there is a fragility and a vulnerability that is innately there just from the moment I walk mm-hmm. on stage, I would guess. But then I also feel like I'm a little bit of a fighter, but there's something sort of tragic about that when you're watching this sort of diminutive person just hang on by her fingernails. I also think Sally Bowles is really charming. And not to say Liza Minnelli wasn't charming, but, you know, that sort of manifests itself in different ways. And jump in, Joel.
What's interesting is I think truly when I start, I just want good actors. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's just all I want. And you certainly think about qualities and all of that. I mean, first of all, I knew Kate could sing the heck out of it. I mean, it's, you know, they took two songs that were written for the movie and put them in the revival in 98. Well, one can debate when that revival happened, but the Sam Mendes revival. So there's that age-old sort of discussion of isn't Sally Bowles actually a sort of down-and-out, not very good singer? And it's like, well, that may be the reality of it, but it's a musical.
Yeah.
And the emotional life of the musical is brought to life in the songs as well as the scenes. And so I think... Interestingly for me, I've only seen the movie a couple of times, and that was a zillion years ago. And my memory of it, knowing a little bit about the show even then, was, oh, they made Liza Minnelli American and the Cliff character British and totally changed the plot. And Fosse did an incredible job of suiting it for Liza Minnelli. But I don't actually think of Liza Minnelli as the obvious choice for Sally Bowles. I think of her as having done a remarkable job with it. But I also haven't seen it in a million years. So, you know, it's a fun question because I feel like, gosh, I'm not sure, but that maybe I shouldn't have.
Let me jump in here so we can take a quick break. My guests are director and choreographer Joel Farrell and actor Kate Weatherhead. They are both involved in the Dallas Theater Center's production of Cabaret. We'll be back in a minute.
Mm-hmm.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. Learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guests this hour are both involved with the Dallas Theater Center's production of Cabaret, which continues through this Sunday, May 22nd. Joel Farrell is director and choreographer, and Kate Weatherhead plays Sally Bowles. If you'd like to join our conversation this afternoon, you can call in. The number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. There is no way to talk about this show without talking about sex. And I wonder what it takes. Maybe you can both talk about this from your perspectives. I mean, you know, you have a lot of dancers and a lot of actors and people who are thought to be very out there. But a lot of performers in their private lives are not out there in quite the same way.
Right.
What does it take to get the cast comfortable enough to sort of not simply get out there on stage, but, you know, in rehearsal sort of be able to be that sexual with one another?
Wow, that's a great question. I think that one of the things that you would hope about actors and dancers, singers in their formative life is that they're asked to risk a lot. They really have to open up very quickly. I think it's sort of a cliche, but cliche is for a reason. That actors bond really quickly. I mean, one thing is we do 8, 9, 10-hour rehearsal days immediately for 6 days a week with one day off. And so, you know, about 4 days in, you sort of feel like you've been, you know, on some sort of retreat with these people and you still have miles and miles
to go. Not a religious retreat in this case.
Not a religious retreat at all. But there is an amazing energy, if it goes well, to rehearsal, in that trust levels have to be built very quickly. Everyone understands that. And so I think two things are true. One is you try to make the absolutely safest place for them. So I think one of the things that was interesting for me in auditioning was bringing up the topic of sexuality, bringing up the topic of nudity, mm-hmm. and you know, revealing of the physical, because it's really important to me that no one ever feels that that's, what's the easiest way? I don't want to feel like the creepy old guy saying, you know, like, so are you comfortable?
So you didn't ask anyone to be nude in auditions or anything like
that? I did
that.
Not. I asked them if they were comfortable with it. I would like to believe I didn't not use anyone, even if they said they would not be comfortable. But I did have to try to find a sense of whether the actors would just be free enough and trusting of one another enough. And I have to say, not only was it a phenomenal group for that, I think the show ultimately makes it easier for you because you know it's not utterly gratuitous. I mean, there's a means to an end. So it's not you know, it's interesting because the minute the idea of brief nudity came up in the show, I think everyone's, you know, your first thought is, oh, gentlemen's club. It's going to be about, and what's interesting is, and not to give away anything, but nudity does not actually come about in the show the way you might think it does.
Yeah.
It's not used as a sort of, you know,
entertainment device.
Shake it in the face kind of thing. Yeah. So, but it is, I am amazed all the time. Having been an actor myself, I'd like to believe I was very, very trusting and all of that. But I never cease to be amazed at what we ask of actors and what they ultimately do without sounding like we're all so remarkable. It takes a lot of fun. It takes an amazing amount of bravery. And they go into scenario after scenario, show after show with a bunch of new people and a bunch of new people leading them often.
Yeah.
So I think when you hear actors in interviews talk about either having great faith in their director or not, a lot of that is just having given them a safe place where they didn't feel traumatized or that there was a predator in the room. So we worked very hard at that. And then, you know, I got to let them sort of do their thing.
I think two things. One, that this production offers an appropriate context for it. So I don't feel like there's a moment where there is nudity that seems gratuitous. It's part of the storytelling. The other thing is that, speaking from personal experience, there's something incredibly empowering about being nude or partially nude on stage. that one, and again, it, that goes hand in hand with the fearlessness that Joel was talking about. And I think as an actor, if, you know, you're always striving to get better and to deepen your level of performance, and that is one means to that end. Because once you do it, it's sort of like, well, what else can I do? I've done, you know, I've literally bared myself to an audience. And the other remarkable thing, I've said this before in a couple conversations, is that at that moment you feel like the most powerful person in the room. And it seems sort of ironic, but you actually realize that you have made the choice. And now it's everyone else's responsibility to respond in their way. And if it is appropriate, which it is, I believe in this production, it feels right. It just does.
I think one of the most astonishing things for me in research, because I know we're talking about nudity, and the question was about the sex in the show, which they're not the same thing necessarily, although sometimes they come in combination. But you know, the sexual exploration of that period, and in that place, was truly a little mind-bending.
Like Athens in the 3rd century B.C.
Right. And I would say every crazy, kinky, you got to be kidding, I cannot imagine that's ever taken place. They were exploring it. I mean, and what's interesting, intriguing, but really difficult, especially when you're going to put that in front of an audience in 2011 in Texas, knowing that it's going to be a pretty wide audience, probably because people think of musicals as sort
you
of
bring
less,
grandma to a musical.
You're right. I mean, it's a musicale. Is that a lot of it in that period had to do with sort of dominance and submission and ownership and abuse. I mean, they were really exploring crazy things. And early on, I had conversations with Kevin Moriarty, our artistic director, in talking conceptually about the show, about the fact that I wanted people to be asked, as they are in the show, to be titillated by it and to say, aren't these sexy bodies, and enjoy it. Because part of what, you know, the Kit Kat Club is representing one of the low clubs, not one of the expensive clubs. I mean, they weren't making money in this club off the drinks. They were making money off the boys and girls, mm-hmm. you know. And I said, and choices I'm making at the end of the show, I want an audience to have to deal with the fact that when you objectify another human, when you devalue them in any way, when they turn into an object of your pleasure or your desire, you run the risk of there being dire consequences to that. So you can devalue them because of what their ethnicity or their gender or their whatever. But ultimately, there is a very, very dark side to that. And so he encouraged me to sort of run with that idea, because I remember seeing the show as a kid and being a little disturbed by the fact that I was as excited and titillated early on, mm-hmm. when in fact part of what you have to come to terms
Suddenly
with –
Suddenly you feel guilty about that.
Right. And part of what you have to come to terms with, all of us, with the Holocaust is, you know, is that this was – well, you know, to say one group of people were devaluing another is the understatement of all time in the history of the world. I mean, it was, you know, a declaration of you are worthless, and not just worthless, but you need to be done away with. And so on a sexual level, but also on a political, social level, you know, we deal with it every day.
And then you have this really stark contrast, because you have all this sexuality that always does feel a little bit desperate and a little bit
right.
It's not sexy sexuality, even though it's hypersexualized.
Right.
On the other hand, you have this incredibly sweet story of Fräulein Schneider and Herr Schultz, mm-hmm. and I'm not sure that you even see them in an extended embrace in the entire production.
Right.
And yet they are really charming, and they're that it really highlights the difference that sometimes exists between love and sex.
Oh, this is too much to accept. So rare, so costly, so luxurious. If you brought me diamonds, if you brought me pearls, if you brought me roses like some other gents might bring to other girls, it couldn't please me more than the gift I see.
pineapple. Your emotion, you began to sway. Went to get some air or rented a chair to keep from fainting dead away. It couldn't please me more than to see you cling to the pineapple I bring.
This is a scene from the Dallas Theater Center's production of Cabaret, which continues through this Sunday, May 22nd. I think, you know, everybody needs that breath of like, oh, you can like these people. They're both very, you care about them. You don't have to feel bad about caring about them. And it's interesting, in the midst of all this sort of growing darkness, in a way, it sort of helps you to understand how people could look away from what was coming, because people did still have regular lives. They were still at Absolutely. This horrible political time, falling in love and you know, eating breakfast and just doing regular things. And maybe it was easy to not fully comprehend what was coming.
Well, again, I think we forget that not only is life just in general hard, you know, I mean, it's like you just keeping on is a little victory every day, which I think most good writers and most good, you know, understand. I mean, if that's what they reflect for us. But in this time in Berlin, I mean, it was really, really a struggle just to stay afloat. I mean, inflation went to this crazy level where, you know, loaves of bread were billions of marks, yeah. as Schneider says in the show. I mean, and you know, I don't know if you haven't lived through something like that. I mean, I know how, you know, my parents lived through the Depression as young people. And I am absolutely certain that everything about how they approached the world from that moment on was different because of that. And I, you know, we're starting to sort of lose that World War II. Well, we've lost the World War I generation. And our partnership with the Dallas Holocaust Museum, which has been a phenomenal, we've gained this new family, I have to say, in a very true sense. But they are a part of the Stay Late Talk Back after each thing. And, you know, they've helped give me a lot of information about what the sort of reality on the street for the common man was. And one of the things that I think is great about the source material all of this came from is that instead of it having been years and years later when somebody decided to write the story, all of it ultimately tracks back to Christopher Isherwood. So the play that became based on his stories, I am a camera in the 50s, and then ultimately. So I have to say, sometimes I forget in situations like this to give Joe Masteroff and Candor and Ebb and Hal Prince the credit for like really knowing the story they wanted to tell. I mean, they shaped it into, you know, some things got carved away, et cetera, as they ultimately decided what the show was going to be. But they were working from source material that clearly they felt very passionate about. And I say all the time that the show premiered in 66, the play was in the 50s. I mean, that's really still a very short time after World War II. Mm-hmm. And but also but yet another tumultuous time for us, because the 60s, you know, were Vietnam and a socio-political movement that was breaking this country apart. So it is, I think Schneider and Schultz are the reminder that not only is companionship from someone willing to, Julie and I talked about a lot in the course of her developing the role. I said, you know, when you have lived through hell alone, you barricade yourself from the world. And so someone saying, I care about you, open to me the way I am willing to open to you, is about as unnerving as anything else in the world. It's your greatest desire somewhere underneath, but you've also steeled yourself against the idea of vulnerability. And what's more vulnerable, you know, at 60 or 65 years of age than starting to explore all those sort of teenage feelings again. And Herr Schultz's downfall, in a sense, in the play, is his utter decency and his willingness to believe that the best will rise. You know, the very last thing he sort of says in the play is, it will not go where you think it's going. I'm a German. I understand the German. You know, so there's just so much in the piece, and I'm
that might be the most poignant line in the play, by the way, when he says, "I'm a German." Like,
right.
Like we get that living in 2011 and understanding, but I guess the average German, Gentile German, wouldn't have agreed with him in 1930.
Well, the folks at the Dallas Holocaust Museum have been a huge help in helping us understand that the German Jews were the most assimilated in all of Europe. In other words, they had great pride in being Germans. Mm-hmm. In fact, I think you would say about people like Herr Schultz, they thought of themselves as a German first and then a Jew, which was not necessarily true of Jews across Europe. And that's sort of mind-bending. One of the responses we had at a – I've told the story two or three times now, but one of the times I got a little emotional was I stayed to listen to a talk back after the show. Young woman raised her hand, said she was very moved by the show and the themes, got a bit emotional, and then added, you know, I'm a young Hispanic woman. And the last 4 or 5 years of life in the United States has scared me very badly to my core. And I thought, now I'm convinced we're doing our job. You know, I mean, when we're only talking about 1931 Berlin, I think, boy, it's unbelievably relevant. It will never not be important. But if you don't see the application as we moved the decades beyond, because, you know, no one wants to believe anything like that could happen again. Little versions of it happen all the time, quite frankly. So,
my guests this hour are director and choreographer Joel Farrell and actor Kate Weatherhead, who plays Sally Bowles in the Dallas Theater Center production of Cabaret. It continues through this Sunday, May 22nd. If you want to be part of the conversation, you can send an email to think@kera.org, or you can call us at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. Learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're talking this hour about Cabaret, which continues at the Wiley Theater. It's a production of the Dallas Theater Center that runs through Sunday, May 22nd. Kate Weatherhead is here. She plays Sally Bowles. And Joel Farrell, director and choreographer, is with us as well. If you want to join us, the number to call is 1-800-933-5372. Kate, this is a really physical show. Do you sort of spend 6 weeks of rehearsal and the entire run worrying that you're, you know, going to twist your knee or something and be in trouble?
No. only because that won't help anybody. Because if I do worry about it, it will happen. Uh-huh. And I have found over the years that if I can keep my stress level down, then I will have greater success. I used to worry and worry and worry about losing my voice. And guess what? I'd always lose my voice. And now I've just decided I'm not going to lose my voice. I'm not going to get sick. I'm not going to get injured. Mm-hmm. That being said, I'm not cavalier about it, and I try and get enough sleep, and I try not to drink too much, and I try and go to the gym and exercise. And I have found in the rehearsal process, you do things in chunks. You know, you don't start the first day and just do run-throughs. So once we started running through the show, I realized just how much energy it required, both physically and emotionally, and then had to figure out, okay, what do I need to do to get through this in a healthy way? again, physically and emotionally. And I have found that protein is my best friend in this. I feel completely depleted at the end of the show, so I find that red meat is really helping me get through this. And then cardio exercise at the gym, because I need to get my heart rate up. The beginning of the show for me, when I come on stage, I have about, what is it, like a 20-minute marathon, yeah, pretty much, where I have almost 3 songs in a row and scenes and costume changes. And the first couple times we did it, I came off stage huffing and puffing. And now I've sort of, you know, also that adrenaline has a lot to do with that as well. And now I've gotten to a place where I can breathe deeply through it and do what I need to do.
The twisted director decided she needed to wear 3.5-inch heels and run up and down stairs. And
yeah. Thank you for that, Joel.
Yeah, you bet.
So, yes, there is a certain amount of physical preparation that it takes. But in terms of worrying about what could happen, that's generally doesn't do anyone any good. And knock on wood, I have 1 week left to go. So.
I just want to say Chris Boyd brought that up.
Yeah, and Chris Boyd, you better start learning my part.
I saw the show already, so it doesn't matter to me. Okay. I want to ask about this because you live in New York. Is that your
yes.
home base? What is it like to sort of pick up everything and for 2 months move somewhere else and feel enough at home that at the end of a hard day you really can relax in your space?
That's a good question. Well, this is actually my third year in a row working at the Dallas Theater Centers, and at this point it's a home away from home. Most actors lead a nomadic life. So at this point in my career, this is not a foreign experience to me. And I've sort of figured out through the years what I need to quickly adapt to a place. And it's generally, you know, finding certain locations, you know, finding the gym and finding your grocery store and bringing certain creature comforts from home. I have a dog, so I bring my dog with me. That helps a lot. Being here now for the third year in a row, I feel a great sense of entitlement to the theater center and the city, and it's like my other home. I absolutely love being here, and this family that Joel keeps referring to, whether they like it or not, I've completely wormed my way in.
Yep. She's the strange cousin from New York that keeps coming back.
It's crazy Kate's back.
Her husband, Jeff Kreuter, is a rather renowned lighting designer, works a lot in New York and on Broadway, but all over the country, and designs for us regularly. So only once have we brought them to town for the same project at the same time, which I think was fun for them. But Jeff has come in and out a couple of times when he had days off, and Willa the dog is keeping her company, et cetera. But a lot of it is a real sort of understanding how to routine yourself to figure out in any new city what gets you comfortable fast, you know. And hoping the theater company also does a nice hospitable job,
which they do here,
which
absolutely.
Is tricky.
Yeah.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go to Louisville and speak with Jim. Hey, Jim.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Just a brief comment and then just a question. One is, my wife and I just finished seeing Cabaret this past Friday evening. Absolutely enjoyed it, and. Coming from somebody like myself, who I usually run with my hair on fire away from musicals because I'm just not that kind of a guy that likes those type of things. And generally, I thoroughly enjoyed myself. And having my wife seen how much fun my wife had at the show was even more fulfilling for me. And that kind of gets a segue into my question is. With that in mind, are there going to be more these types of immersive types of interactions with future productions of other works? Because it really, we were observers of the play, but of the show, but in other respects, we were kind of part of it as well. And I thought that was a really neat thing. And I can imagine from a production that's taking a risk, and I really applaud. Everybody involved for that type of risk. It really made the show, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, Jim, thanks for your call. Let's get an answer for you.
Well, first of all, Jim, you may be doomed now. You've said you like musicals in front of your wife.
Next up, Oklahoma.
Exactly. Hope that's the case. You know, what's interesting for us is I think, again, I'm going to bring up Kevin Moriarty, our artistic director. Sorry, it's my Texas dialect beating me up. Because I think a couple of things are true. I think, you know, we understandably through his leadership sort of spin off of his aesthetic and his, you know, his love of certain types of theater. And we share a sort of idea that we want to make every theater experience in a dream world would be very unique and very special and would be immersive in a way. And well before Kevin had a voice or I had a voice, they started the process of building this new theater space for us, which was based on a lot of smart research and a lot of discussion about how to give artists the most wonderful canvas, you know, how to give us the coolest transformer space. So for anybody who hasn't been to the Wiley Theater, you know, I'm not even sure we have begun to crack the nut. But it was really important not only to keep exploring that space, which is willing to do things that almost no other theater space is willing to do. But I think that in a weird way, that's always the challenge in a proscenium show is how to get it, as we say, over the footlights so that an audience doesn't sort of sit back and think entertainment. They lean forward and think interaction. So when you have a space that begs you, you know, to explore it. So I would say, Jim, the other great thing is you should come back and see The Wiz because not to give anything away, but if you think cabaret is a wild ride, Kevin has a way of approaching things as a, you know, with design teams, with amazing bravery. But it's, and I think it's not only a call to arms for the space, but I think it's a part of sort of who we are as a theater that we want people to walk out saying, that was incredibly unique, even if it's a production. For instance, I say a lot about cabaret that people come to it with a lot of expectations. And some of those are really quick snippets, you know, that Liza Minnelli, whatever. But that's an interesting thing. It can be a little daunting, but it's but in a sense, it's exactly like you go see any piece of Shakespeare. I mean, if you're a literary person or a theater person, you know the work already. You're going to see the interpretation. You want to see what that set of designers and that actor in that space does with that piece. So that's the fun of it. I don't think any of us ever thought about what had come before with cabaret. We just stripped it back to the text and the music and started playing and had an amazing set of designers. They pushed me in great directions, which is the thrill of having a great design team.
I would imagine they do a lot of research ahead of time as well.
Oh, my gosh. I mean, just, yeah, voluminous. I mean, that's the fun, too. I say all the time, you know, you have so much fun just prepping before you ever get to the rehearsal studio. And then you're trying not to have made all the decisions so thoroughly, but that the actors can't then inform you. So I frequently say to scenic designers, for instance, I want it to be the kind of space where if I were a kid, I would get all freaky excited. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? I would just be like, ooh, I want to get up on that. Or I want to
play on it.
Yeah, I want to play on it. I want to get on those monkey bars. I mean, that is, whether we admit it or not in adulthood, still what drives us towards something is that very just sort of kinetic, like, ooh, that looks like fun. Or, ooh, I want to see through that or whatever. And then, you know, you hope that the actors sort of take that crazy space you've created for them and run wild with it. And I would say this group of people has run about as amok as amok gets. So with all within reason, but it's a really fun space to play in.
What are the conversations like, Kate, when the play is coming together? Obviously, you're being directed, but you have your own ideas. I mean, do you sort of stop and say, hang on, can we try this? Or is that a conversation you have after a particular rehearsal period is over?
Oh, I would say it's during the rehearsal process. And Joel's so incredible in that he...
I just slipped for a 20.
Yes, thank you for that. Yeah. In that he comes so prepared with so many ideas and at the same time is completely open to suggestions and problem solving. And as we worked, particularly even the songs too, but certainly in the scenes... we would just, you know, if we had a question or if something didn't feel right, we would just stop and say, this doesn't feel, I feel like I'd be looking at her. I feel like I wouldn't be looking at her. I feel like I'd be doing something else right now. And then you just play until you figure out what feels right. And that's, I mean, that's the fun. That's why we all right. do this. Because that's the process of ownership. And then it becomes yours more and more. One can only hope that they get a director like Joel who is as open-minded and yet thoughtful at the same time. So I never left rehearsal going, well, nobody knows what's going on.
I did.
So once the run has begun and you're there in front of an audience, I mean, obviously in a musical in particular, you can listen for applause and you can listen for laughter. Right. In the times in between, when there isn't applause and there's not laughter, are you still listening for what they're, how they're responding? Are you conscious of them at all?
I'm going to borrow Joel's word that he just used and say it's more kinetic. You're feeling the energy, and it is palpable. I can't, I'll never be able to describe it, but it is electric, the connection with the audience. You can almost feel their breath at times. So they don't need to be making a sound, but their presence is felt. And it's not because of that, the need for laughter or applause diminishes unless you feel them retreating. And thankfully with this production, I have not felt that at all. I mean, I feel them engaged and listening. And then the safety on that is that the one constant are the other actors on stage.
Mm-hmm. So you've got their energy.
Yeah. So if tonight, for whatever reason, everyone falls asleep, I can look at Lee Troll on stage and know that I'm getting everything that I need from him because we've done our work and we've established our chemistry and we can still tell the story that needs to be told. But we're just lucky in that the unseen actor in this play is a very good one. I mean, our audiences have been really strong and really, really responsive.
So what do you know about the show that the actors who never get to see themselves performing don't know?
Wow.
And sadly, I've given you like 35 seconds to answer.
No, it's fine. That's wise. 3 minutes, we'd just be in some sort of horrible cycle of my pondering and babbling. I think part of what is astonishing for me about the actors. Good actors rarely, in a weird way, know how good they are. But there is so much, you know, the band is on stage in Cabaret. The musicians are phenomenal. They're completely invested. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're literally as characters in the piece. I mean, they are, you know, we haven't stuck them in a pit, which is a beautiful thing, but it's really nice to have them. And then visually, there are so many layers at work, thanks to the great work of Bob Lavalle, the set designer, and Lap Chi Chu, who design lighting, and Clint Ramos, who did costumes, that I think it's hard until you've seen it to sort of realize how many layers of the onion are peeled away for you.
Joel Farrell is director and choreographer of the Dallas Theater Center's production of Cabaret. Kate Weatherhead plays Sally Bowles. The run continues at the Wiley through Sunday, May 22nd. It's been great to have you both. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
The Think production team includes engineer Nilufer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.